Alcoholism and drug abuse tear lives apart. People go into treatment and maybe they receive some tender, loving care. They get off. But when they're done, their lives are still in shambles. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Hello, everyone. This is Ned Wicker, and you're listening to Recovery Now. Transitional living is an aspect of recovery that we don't always talk about. Alongside is the Reverend Dr. Dan Geeting. And Dan, we know of a transitional living facility that's very near and dear to our heart that really helps people get back on their feet once again.
I'm glad to be here today, and I'm so glad that we are addressing this issue, and also for us to be able to look at something that really helps recovery and maybe gets it cemented in a person's life, that so many times they can go through treatment and get all the help, but it's just sort of like, okay, where do I go now? And it reinforces their program and it gives them stability in the recovery process.
And very near and dear to the heart of our special guest is the Wisconsin Nazarene Compassionate Center. And here today with us is Pam Eicher, who's the executive director of that center. And Pam, welcome. Glad to see you.
I'm glad to be here.
Why don't we start? Tell us a little bit about yourself. This center has been going for a number of years. You have been the driving force behind it. And how did all that come about?
Wisconsin Nazarene Compassionate Center started 14 years ago. It was a vision from some congregations, members from the Nazarene Church in Milwaukee. They felt that they wanted to be part of the solution to Milwaukee's homeless population. And so they started investigating how they could get involved and be a help. And the director at the time, John Hooper, was serving on the board of Bootstrap Incorporated. And they operated a transitional facility. And the owners, directors at the time, really wanted to get out of the housing industry and move into some other areas. And so Wisconsin Nazarene Compassionate Center was formed around that, in the idea of coming in to manage the transitional program for them. And after about 7 years, we purchased the building and the program from them. And we have been doing it ever since. I have been there 14 years, and it has been nothing short of exciting.
14 years. Now, people throw a lot of terms around. Someone might call that a residential facility, and you call it a transitional living center. What's the difference between that?
Residential typically refers to clinical services, such as your treatment programs, your detox, those types of things. While we do residential services, transitional living is the next step after treatment. You know, only 10% of the problem are the drugs and alcohol. 90% of the problem are the attitudes, thoughts, and behaviors of the addict. And so you need a place where you can practice being different. These people have been addicts and alcoholics for, I've seen them, up to 40 years of their life. Imagine how good you have to be at something if you've done it for 40 years. We're asking you to completely wipe all of that away and start over and recreate yourself as a new recovery person. And that's not like flipping a switch. You have to take time to practice those kinds of attitudes, thoughts, and behaviors. So that's what transitional does. We monitor those things and help people as they're working the 12 steps. You know, we're guiding them along and checking them when we see what we affectionately call dope fiend behavior or attitudes and thoughts that are very addictive. That's what we work on.
One thing I was just wondering, with this type of a program, the people that would come to you or individuals that seek you out, is there a high funding? Is that insurance based? How would people get into your facility, and how does that run? Is there a work program? What are some of the components that you have in your residential, or I should say, again, transitional setting here?
Well, you've asked two different types of questions. So I'll start with funding. Our program does not receive currently any city, state, or federal funding. We are funded entirely by our residents or private grants and donations. It currently in our program costs $400 a month to stay in our program. That's $100 a week. Now, to a homeless person, that sounds like a lot. But to walk into a residential place, it would be three times that. And so for what we offer, the supervision, the zero tolerance, you know, the groups and things like that, you can't, $100 is a steal. We currently have we are part of a provider network with the County of Milwaukee, where we have entered into agreement to provide transitional housing for residents of Milwaukee County. They are screened through a center, and then they are referred out to different types of services. So we do receive a number of clients from that. We get our referrals come from all different kinds of resources, whether it's social services, child welfare, detox centers, treatment centers, probation, parole, state correctional facilities, hospital units, you name it. We've gotten referrals from it. So we've had people come in walking across, you know, in front of the building and see the sign and walk in and ask. You want to know about the components of our program. We offer a zero tolerance. We are not in the business of promoting the relapse, use, and or abuse of drugs and alcohol. I'm not willing to risk the sobriety of the house or the safety of the people that live in our program for someone who makes a poor choice. It doesn't take a physics degree to figure out that drugs and alcohol don't solve any of your problems or issues. It hasn't done it in the past. The news flash is it isn't going to happen in the future. So the zero tolerance, this is where we weed out the people who aren't serious. Because, you know, we're getting into the winter months, and there's people just looking for a bed. They don't last long in our program because there's expectations. We operate it on a membership concept. So if they're accepted through the interview process, they become a member of our recovery club. And with membership comes expectations. Number one, you must be employed, enrolled in school, or doing volunteer work, something productive. You need to enter and complete outpatient treatment, which 9 times out of 10 is funded by the county. You need to attend a minimum of 3 recovery meetings, whether AA, NA, or CA, and you have to have at least one sponsor and weekly contact with your sponsor. Our program is about accountability and responsibility, two things that have been missing in NX Live for the entire addiction process. So they are accountable and responsible to the staff, to the house, and to the other members.
That's wonderful, and you really help us to see that structure that can be there for them, saying we want you to be a success, but it really puts it on the doorstep of themselves, and that they need to see the put into action their recovery thoughts and principles, but there is accountability, and so it keeps them on track.
Exactly.
I can imagine there's a lot of people who are thinking right now, you know, I have relapsed and I have had to go into treatment. Some people that I've met have been in treatment many times. So they're thinking, boy, that's a little harsh. But obviously, your program has worked over the years and the zero tolerance. And what happens to those people who fall through the cracks on that issue if they relapse?
It means that they are terminated from the program. They are given an opportunity to pack up their things, pack a bag, and then they are referred to shelters or other programs. You relapse, you can't stay. And if somebody relapses, we'd like to see before they come back, we want to see that they've done something different and have made some changes before we will let them back in.
So the accountability goes beyond just we expect you to follow the rules, but you are also providing those skills and helping them re-enter the community as well. So it's a, I just see a lot of things going on here.
Right, and part of our programming is offering resources to services that they would need that we don't necessarily have in-house. We focus strictly on the housing component, so everything else is done outside of our organization, whether it's counseling, whether children are in foster care system, if it's job, employment skill training, resume things. There are all kinds of resources in every community, especially from faith-based organizations that are free to, the city or the community. And we access those as quickly as possible for clients. Each community will have food banks to help. While we have a pantry, it's not all inclusive. So there are food banks in our city that we can access. There are clothing pantries for individuals that are going, for women going into work that need business attire. There's a place called the Bottomless Closet that is just fabulous. Doesn't cost them anything. We can get them free medical care, free dental care. We've even figured out how to get free GAMP insurance, which is the county-run insurance program. So they can get medical services, eyeglasses, or whatever else they would need. That's part of... Part of the barrier for addicts is, I find it astounding, is when they get into recovery, all of a sudden they get stupid. I can't do this. I can't do that. Oh, woe is me. Can you hold my hand? And it's like, I look at them and I just have to say, do you remember where you came from and what you did to get that drug or drink? Why is it so difficult for you to step out and reach out your hand for help now? You were asking for handouts when you were using. You can do the same now to get what you need so that you are successful. Our job is to help people be successful outside of our program.
I think one of the things also that you were saying is that there can be the victim mentality, poor me. And like somebody always said, if you stay that way too long, you say, poor me, and pour me another drink.
Yeah.
And that, but I really like that thing of accountability and reminding them, you have a lot to offer and you can do it. So those are the things that I was looking at. And then one of the things I was going to ask you, how long have they stayed in your program? And what are some success stories that you have been able to see after 14 years? You probably have an alumni group that, or some individuals that you can see where they went from transitional into their own life story, and it continues to be written.
Typically in the recovery community, transitional living has been seen as a six-month program. I have a real problem with that because 6 months is the first time your body is completely clean of everything that you've ever put into it. And interestingly enough, at that same time, we start seeing changes in mental health issues or physically. People have used drugs and alcohol to cover up mental illnesses, or they've used drugs and alcohol to cover up pain. And, when those things start cropping up, that's a really good excuse to go back to what they used to do. So 6 months is really, that's just the edge. Typically, voluntarily in our program, our stay is 9 months or better, closer to a year. And the objective is, you need to resolve the baggage you've had that you used as an excuse to use, whether it's low self-esteem, abandonment issues, sexual, physical or emotional abuse. It can be a litany of things. But until you resolve those issues, when you are stressed, when the situations, get really critical, those making the poor choices you made become really easy at that point in time. So you need to resolve those. You need to take those things and get them out of the way. You need to resolve any mental health issues. You need to resolve your physical issues before you decide to move on. We've had, this year, we've had 10 people move out successfully from our program. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but that is because relapse is a very big component of recovery. It happens. You know, and people use all kinds of excuses when they relapse. But the point is they choose to use. I have one gentleman in our that moved from our program. Dan came to us, had been homeless since the age of 14, has a mental health diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia, had not had a history of long-term medications, compliance with medications, had a long history of hospitalizations in and out. He had some real issues. And when we got him, I will be honest with you, I didn't think he was going to make it. He became part of a county-funded program where he was given a case manager. He was put into treatment. He got some help with employment, job preparation. He worked with Goodwill Industries and, you know, things like that. And he had a year. And suddenly his job kind of went south. And he lost a job. And that slip up, because his time had ended with the case management program, he kind of fell through the cracks. And just us wasn't enough to hold him. And he didn't use, he walked away. So he was gone for a couple months, and he came back. I saw him one day on the street and asked him how he was doing. And, you know, he said, not really well. And I said, Dan, get back. Come back home. He came back. He was with us for 6 months, and we referred him to a permanent housing program, which is a big push now for homelessness, through the guest house of Milwaukee. And he now has his own apartment and has maintained his sobriety. He comes back every Monday. I can count on Dan showing up in our office to, you know, just talk and, you know, just talk about the Brewers specifically because he's such a baseball fan. But, you know, just to keep in touch. And he is doing so well. And it's so wonderful to know that we were part of that. You know, and to see someone be so successful and, you know, make a complete change of their life. You know, he's still dealing with some of his issues, but, you know, he's doing really well, and it's exciting.
And he's living the normal life because all of us have issues that were, it's a constant way of life and living, but I'm sure that all of the residents that get to know him, he's a beacon of hope. That if he can do it, you know, I can do it too.
Definitely.
What's kind of amazing to me about hearing one of these stories is you're kind of an oasis in a very marginal area of town. The near west side of Milwaukee is known, what's the term for crack alley?
Yeah.
And there's just a lot of that type of activity going on, and then here you are.
Yeah, we have our... On Well Street, where our facility is located, has been affectionately termed Crack Alley by our local alderman. And I took great offense to that. because, yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter where you go in any city. You can find drugs and alcohol if you just look. I mean, you can walk down the corner and somebody can approach you. Are you looking? And so, you can walk out your front door. It doesn't matter where you live. We've been very fortunate. We've had some significant police presence in our neighborhoods this past summer. And I felt we've had a very good summer. The violence was kept down. I affectionately refer to people in the neighborhood as the village idiots that, you know who I'm talking about, the ones that are always causing trouble. You know, they have been very minimal. And I always tell our residents, you know, when you leave the front door, if you look like a victim, you're going to be treated like a victim. Walk with your head up. If somebody approaches you, look at them and say, I'm sorry, I'm not interested, and just walk away.
Over the 14 years and all of the ups and downs and all the buildings that you have been, all the programs you've gone through, what keeps you ticking? What are your passions? I just sense so much passion from you here and so much commitment to this. And I was just wondering what fuels that.
I didn't start out to be a Compassionate Ministries director at all. Matter of fact, I can remember growing up, acknowledging that there's no way God would call me to do anything like this because I have too big of a mouth. I'm not afraid to say anything. Absolutely not. So I thought there's no way. But I knew that I was very good at listening to people, and counseling was an area I was interested in. So I went off to school and got a bachelor's in psychology with a special emphasis in interpersonal relationships, thinking that I could counsel somebody. Come back to the state of Wisconsin and you need a master's degree. Yeah, so that was put on hold for a while. But I did go back and get a master's. Was going to go into school counseling, high school guidance counseling. And just as I completed my master's program, the major budget cuts in education came through. And the first jobs they eliminate are in the guidance office. So there I am with a degree and no place to practice. It was at that time that WNCC, as we call ourselves, started. And I actually started out as the education coordinator on a volunteer basis. And the next thing I know, I'm the director. in terms of, it's funny because having never seen myself do this, I can't imagine doing anything else. I don't picture myself doing this for the rest of my life. I would love to teach nonprofit management someday in the college level. There's a number of people that have been called to the ministries. And while this is a ministry, this is first a business. And you have to run it as a business. So we need to teach our up-and-coming people how to do these things. I love watching lights go on above people's heads. I get it. That really turns me on. I love to see that. I'm a control freak, so it works really well. I get to tell people what to do. So, this works really well into my strengths in that area. But I love helping people. That's my passion.
Thank you so very much. I just have just marveled at the things that have happened in the facility that you're at, and I know it's a beacon of hope in our community.
Yeah, and Pam, we want to ask you to come back next week because we want to talk about transitional living centers and residential living centers and all that that encompasses, because there's a wide variety of centers out there, and some of the questions that we get all the time is how do I select one, but we'll be doing that next week. So Pam, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Dan, it's always a pleasure when you come up with these wonderful guests.
Well, I tell you, I'm just having fun in the recovery community and seeing what people are doing. There's so much hope out there for each one.
And that's really the center of what we're trying to do here. There is hope. And Pam had talked about making choices. And one of the choices is I want to get better. And I am going to allow someone to help me. And more importantly, I'm just going to allow myself to be loved and cared for. And for those of you familiar with the 12 steps, I'm sure you're understanding that I just gave you steps 1, 2, and 3. So next week, we'll be talking about that. For those of you listening on your iTunes, you can also get more information if you surf the web and go to drug-addiction-support.org or alcoholism-support.org. Those are our two websites. Much more information on that. So we thank you for listening to Recovery Now. And until next week, just understand that God loves you. Look up. He's there. Bye-bye.